be here with our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KBOO News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KBOO's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KBOO News.
KBOO's Eduardo Delanderos Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KBOO News.
I'm Michael Newman, KBOO News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KBOO News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Free Speech Radio News interviews the Washington soldier who refuses to deploy to Iraq with his Stryker Brigade.
Another Ohio state official pleads guilty to corruption charges tracing back to George Bush's electoral victory in 2004.
An independent Iraqi group present the results of its investigation into the Haditha massacre.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq, as of today, there have been 2,483 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers. IraqBodyCount.org reports that as many as 42,646 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Other experts estimate the true Iraq body count may be as high as a quarter million dead.
This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 7, 2006. I'm Afifa Ahmed Shafi.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. The newly formed Working Families Party has turned in petitions with more than 20,000 signatures to qualify for Oregon's ballot. State officials say the party needs 18,908 valid signatures. They have until January of 2008 to get them. Organizers are working overtime to gain signatures early enough to get on this November's ballot. A national party that first formed in New York, the Working Families Party is known for its strategy of fusion voting, in which multiple parties can nominate the same person for an office. If that were restored in Oregon, the party hopes Democrats, Republicans, and others would come to the party to seek a dual nomination in exchange for supporting its goals. A ballot initiative effort to put fusion voting on the November ballot has been dropped. Organizers say they'll build a coalition to lobby the legislature to bring it back for 2007.
The Ben Lapine School District has banned youth pastors from a local evangelical church from visiting students in the school cafeteria during the lunch hour. Leaders of Ben's Westside Church say they regularly visited students who were part of their youth ministry program at four middle schools and three high schools in Bend. But some parents found out about the visits and complained to school and school district officials. Westside pastors deny any religious recruiting at the schools. But Ben Lapine Superintendent Doug Nelson said he received reports that the pastors were using the visits to organize youth group members and perhaps introduce other children to the program. In 2000, the Molalla River School District tightened lunchtime visitor rules after parents complained that a church youth pastor was offering faith-based answers to students' concerns.
For the first time, a U.S. Army officer has refused to serve in Iraq when his deployment orders are given by the end of the month. FSRN's Sarah Olson has this update.
Aaron Watada will become one of the first commissioned officers to speak publicly against the war in Iraq today. He's a 27-year-old first lieutenant in the United States Army. Watada turned in his resignation to protest the Iraq war in January of this year.
I've come to believe that this isn't illegal, an immoral war, and that the order to have us deployed to Iraq is unlawful.
Watada says his duty as a commissioned officer is to the Constitution. He says the human toll, both in the United States and in Iraq, has moved him to resign.
You see these clips of the funerals of these families and the children. The one really hard picture for me was the little boy walking out of the funeral for his father who was killed. He can't even face the camera, so he's covering his eyes. I just felt like that I wasn't going to be silent anymore and condone what I felt was something that was deeply wrong.
Watada plans to refuse his orders to deploy to Iraq in late June. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Sarah Olson in Olympia, Washington.
Last week's blockade of the Port of Olympia was one of the largest gatherings of the growing anti-war movement in the country. One activist from Vancouver was there and witnessed the events. KBOO's Doug Guidi reports.
Last week's anti-war protest and blockade in Olympia was one of the region's biggest shows of force against the military's war in Iraq and involved several people from the Portland-Vancouver region. The reason was to stop the flow of the delivery of Stryker fighter vehicles. The military continues to ship off equipment and hardware to Iraq. As the ongoing war and occupation of Iraq continues to be more and more unpopular with the American public, Washington State's Fort Lewis is home to the military's 3rd Brigade, 2nd Infantry Division, and its Stryker vehicles. The vehicles were being sent from Fort Lewis to the Port of Olympia, where the Strykers were being loaded onto the U.S. Navy ship Pomeroy, the largest ship ever to dock in Olympia. Word got out quickly in Olympia about the delivery, and activists from around the region decided to block the gates of the port. Denmark Witcher, an activist from Vancouver, Washington, was there. He's from Vancouver for Peace.
Much of the protesting was vigiling. Some of it was attempts to stop the convoys, which were on their way from Fort Lewis to the port for ship to Iraq. And there were people during the early part of the 10 days who stood in the way of the convoy, and the convoy was interrupted. Naturally, nobody's pretending that it's going to that the interruption will last forever, but it was very effective. And then the night of the 29th, which would have been Memorial Day, the ship arrived, and so that cranked everybody to a higher level of concern. And the police became noticeably more aggressive, and they sprayed a whole lot of people that night.
The Port Plaza became the epicenter of the Olympia protest. According to a press release from Seattle Indie Media, around 11 p.m., about 25 protesters left the group at Port Plaza and marched through downtown Olympia, occupying all lanes of traffic on 4th Avenue from Capitol Way to Plum Street, and briefly occupied the intersection between I-5 and the Port of Olympia. After rattling the gates outside the Port of Olympia, tensions arose when the spray was released, a clear overreaction by many, including Denmark Wisher.
There was confrontation, or, you know, standoff, let's say, between protesters and police. And eventually the police started arresting, dragging people away. There was some chemical spraying going on, and then people didn't know what to do next. There was a circle formed, and people were deciding on jail support and so on, and what else could be done on the premises, because it was clear that the point was made and that the police were not going to allow the protesters to go any further than they already had.
The protests at the Port of Olympia could be a sign of things to come this summer as Iraq becomes more unpopular in America and military facilities and ports become focal points of the anti-war movement. Those arrested at the Port of Olympia protests are receiving some assistance. Denmark Wishar.
There is a defense fund that's been started. People who are interested in details and the unfolding story would probably want to go to OLE IMC. It's oleimc.infotage.net.
And more on the anti-war movement in Vancouver can be found at vancouverforpeace.org. I'm Doug Guidi, KBOO News.
The popularity of methamphetamine is causing the Klamath County Jail to expand for the first time since it opened more than 16 years ago. Klamath County Sheriff Tim Evinger says the extra space is needed to deal with drug-addicted women. By the end of the month, the number of beds for women will rise from 12 to 20. The sheriff says for years he has considered providing more jail beds for women, but his sergeant suggested remodeling one of the men's units that had an open dormitory-style room. Showers were already available for that unit. The makeover cost, the sheriff's department less than $5,000, and the women will be moved into the dormitory this month.
There has been a rash of thefts from farms and nurseries in the Mid-Willamette Valley. Scrap metal is fetching a high price. Aluminum prices are at an 18-year high. Experts say thefts of any type of metal is taking off. Someone stole pipe fittings and other aluminum irrigation parts from Anderson's Grower Direct Nursery in Aurora recently. After contacting the police, Richard Anderson, the owner of the nursery, notified area scrapyards. By Monday, Salem police arrested a man for the crime. Experts say the demand from Asia is driving the metals market and that drug addiction in the United States is fueling the metal thefts. Anderson gives kudos to the Western Recycling, which questions sellers before accepting scrap metal.
There's a public meeting tonight in Eugene where the green waterfront may give way to increased urban development. For the Eugene Report, Amy Merwin has more.
This is Inform Radio, progressive news and community affairs from Eugene, Corvallis, and Southern Cascadia.
This is Amy Merwin. On Wednesday, June 7th, at the McNeil Riley House, there will be a presentation and a discussion about Eugene's riverfront. The presenter is Philip Carroll, who is a graduate student in public administration at the University of Oregon and a current Eugene Planning Commissioner.
What I've realized realized is that we haven't had a good community look at what the river means to us and how we can best grow as a city and protect the river's health.
What type of design would contribute to both the health of the Willamette River as well as to creating a more accessible part of the river for being able to access the river with beauty and businesses?
The eastern portion of the E-Web site is quasi-industrial, and so it's hard to make public access work with that kind of use. There's a bike path right along the riverbank, so there is the skeleton of a public access system there. But one thing that I think is going to be very important in the coming years is how to redevelop the E-Web site, because it is downtown's link to the river. So we have the new courthouse and the courthouse district, and some portion of that site is being designed. The roadways are being realigned. E-Web is just in the very early phases of planning their move off of the riverfront site, and so we have an opportunity to increase public access and improve the health of the river. But in doing those two things, we have to take a careful look at what are the conditions and what decisions would really meet both goals. Part of the conversation is, can we have a welcoming public riverfront, but at the same time improve water and habitat quality? We have congregated in our cities, and we have invested in human uses along the river to the detriment of the river's health. We continue to improve those areas from the human perspective and simply try to mitigate natural harm, or are we going to try to actually increase the health of the river? And if so, how do we do that? Simply having landscaping along the river bank may or may not improve the river's health. So how much landscaping there is, or what are the aesthetic values of the riverfront, is a land use discussion. May or may not have a bearing on the health of the river itself.
Are there models anywhere that can merge those two human and ecosystem interests?
I think people appreciating the river and its system is going a long way towards improving the river's health. Being near the river is absolutely a goal we should strive for. Whether there are models that I think Eugene should strive for, not to my knowledge. I think we can create the model. We have people who know a lot and are particularly interested in low-impact building and construction and landscaping. We have people who know the river's ecosystem, and the sticking point to me is agreeing on what sort of paradigm to work in. Most of the riverfront in Eugene is publicly owned. We are very fortunate to have a park system for the majority of the land between the I-5 and the Beltline Bridge. Those lands that are private, some of them approach the river in a unappreciative way, and so we have to work with what we've got, and that's part of the trick too. There are existing incentives for working with the natural system of the river. For example, Eugene has just adopted new provisions to protect the Willamette River, the main stem, but also its tributaries here in town. That requires landowners to not do new construction within certain distances of the top of the riverbank and to manage for native vegetation. What might be helpful to create the broader vision, then we can get down to the nitty-gritty about either regulations or design standards or incentives. So that's the stage we need to focus on now. The river in many places really does not look anything like it did 150 years ago. And so in our urban areas in particular, we have to agree on the goal. That's part of the challenge.
People can contact Inform Radio at amy@informproductions.com.
Food is the topic for this week's edition of Our Backyard, the Earth Activist Report by KBOO's Edison Carter.
Welcome to Our Backyard, locally produced reports and commentary about issues affecting food, water, and air quality in our backyard. This edition, organic food achieves mainstream status and why this may not necessarily be a good thing. This past weekend, Michael Pollan, author of the superb book, The Botany of Desire, A Plant's Eye View of the World, and more recently, the fascinating best-selling The Omnivore's Dilemma, A Natural History of Four Meals, and a recent on-air guest of KBOO's Barbara Bernstein on her excellent program, Locus Focus, wrote a very informing article in the New York Times Magazine. In it, he explains how corporations have tumbled to the idea that there is indeed a market for organic foods and, more to the point, profits to be made. Pollan is an excellent writer. Here's an example. 30 years ago, the rap on organic was a little different. Back then, the stuff was derided as hippie food, crunchy granola and brick-like brown bread for the unshaved set, male and female division. And today, he adds, eating organic has been fixed in the collective imagination as an upper-middle-class luxury, a blue state affectation as easy to mock as Volvos or lattes. On the cultural spectrum, organic stands at the far opposite extreme from NASCAR or Walmart. Here's where the paradigm shifts. Pollan reports that, beginning later this year, Walmart plans to roll out a complete selection of organic foods, foods certified by the USDA to have been grown without synthetic pesticides or fertilizers in its nearly 4,000 stores. Just as significant, the company says it will price all this organic food at an eye-poppingly tiny premium over its already cheap conventional food. Like most stories, there are two sides, and this story has both good and bad. Pollan clearly points out the good. Because of its scale and efficiency and notorious ruthlessness, Walmart will force down the price of organics, and that is a good thing for all the consumers who can't afford to spend more for food than they already do. Walmart will also educate the millions of Americans who don't yet know exactly what organic food is or precisely how it differs from conventionally grown food. The vast expansion of organic food land it will take to feed Walmart's new appetite is also an unambiguous good for the world's environment, since it will result in substantially less pesticide and chemical fertilizer being applied to the land somewhere. And he's just as clear on the bad. Assuming it's possible at all, how exactly would Walmart get the price of organic food down to a level just 10% higher than that of its everyday food? To do so would virtually guarantee that Walmart's version of cheap organic food is not sustainable, at least not in any meaningful sense of that word. To index the price of organic food to the price of conventional is to give up right from the start on the idea once enshrined in the organic movement that food should be priced not high or low, but responsibly. As the organic movement has long maintained, cheap industrial food is cheap only because the real costs of producing it are not reflected in the price at the checkout. Rather, these costs are charged to the environment in the form of soil depletion and pollution. Industrial agriculture is now our biggest polluter. To the public purse in the form of subsidies to conventional commodity farmers. To the public health in the form of an epidemic of diabetes and obesity that is expected to cost the economy more than $100 billion per year. And to the welfare of the farm and food factory workers, not to mention the well-being of the animals we eat. As Wendell Berry once wrote, the motto of our conventional food system, at the center of which stands Walmart, the biggest purveyor of cheap food in America, should be cheap at any price. We're also going to see more organic milk and organic foods of all kinds coming from places like New Zealand. The globalization of organic food is already well underway. At Whole Foods, you can buy organic asparagus flown in from Argentina, raspberries from Mexico, and grass-fed meat from New Zealand. In an era of energy scarcity, the purchase of such products does little to advance the idea of sustainability that once upon a time animated the organic movement. These foods may contain no pesticides, but they are drenched in petroleum even so. And federal organic standards are currently under attack. Pollan candidly expresses his concerns when he says, "Forgive my skepticism, but it's hard to believe that the lobbyists from Walmart are going to play a constructive role in defending those standards from efforts to weaken them." Just this past year, the Organic Trade Association used lobbyists who work for Kraft Foods to move a bill through Congress that will make it easier to include synthetic ingredients in products labeled organic. We are indeed fortunate here in our backyard to have responsible organic farmers and their markets that enable us to buy local and buy with confidence. Support local organic farms and cooperatives. We'll keep a close eye on the corporate industrialization of organic agriculture and report how the relentless hunger for profit affects us all. In the meantime, keep listening to KBOO News and Public Affairs and stay informed. After all, this is our backyard.
In In Washington State, the Kitsap County prosecutor has dropped felony domestic violence charges against a former Bremerton police officer who's been accused of beating his wife. Instead, prosecutors gave 42-year-old William Boswell Cook a diversion agreement for misdemeanor charges of fourth-degree assault and third-degree malicious mischief. The agreement means he will face no jail time, but will be on probation for 2 years and will have to pay court fees, attend mental health counseling, and perform community service. Cook had been accused of punching his then-wife in the face and grabbing her by the throat during a fight in 1997. He was charged with second-degree assault, but not until 2003, when a former Poolsbo police officer who was friends with Cook went to Poolsbo's police chief and reported the allegations. Deputy Prosecutor Christy Barham says the charges were reduced because prosecutors did not believe they could prove the case beyond a reasonable doubt.
L.A. police have turned the preliminary results of an inquiry into the fatal police shooting of a toddler last summer over to the DA's office and expect a final report to be released next month. That's according to Police Captain Jim Vogue, who addressed the police commission yesterday about the internal investigation into the shooting of 19-month-old Susie Pena. Pena was killed on July 19th when her father used her as a shield in a gunfight with LAPD officers. The father was also killed and one officer was wounded. Police Commission President John Mack says he wants a thorough, comprehensive probe into the girl's death, but he says long investigations aggravate relations with community members who want to know what's going on.
Former California Congressman Ron Dellums has won the Oakland mayor's race. Dellums won 50% of the vote compared to City Council President Ignacio De La Fuente's 33%. There are still as many as 5,000 absentee ballots uncounted, and Dellums has hesitated on declaring victory, and his challenger is refusing to concede. The final vote count was expected to drag on several days after a tally that was prolonged by a return to paper ballots. The election was drawn out after Alameda County returned to low-tech voting because state-of-the-art touchscreen machines failed to meet federal and state standards. Alameda County has a shortage of optical scanners to process the paper ballots.
And voters at some polling places in San Joaquin County, California, were turned away during yesterday's election because of machine glitches and the lack of voting inspectors. The county's registrar of voters says a handful of Stockton-area precincts polling places opened as much as 3 hours late after voting inspectors did not show up for work. Voters were sent to nearby polling places where they were allowed to cast provisional ballots. Machine problems caused other voters to be sent away without being able to vote in Stockton, Lodi, Tracy, and Murata. Official says the machines were touchscreen devices manufactured by Diebold Election Systems.
The U.S. Senate today fell short of the 60 votes needed to end debate on a constitutional amendment to ban same-gender marriage. Darby Hickey reports.
With the amendment's failure expected beforehand, critics called the Senate vote today a cynical attempt by Republican leadership, in collusion with President Bush, to improve their ratings in the polls. Though the vote for the amendment to proceed fell 11 short of the 60 needed, backers of the amendment rallied 49 votes in their favor. Kansas Senator Sam Brownback is expected to run for the Republican presidential nomination in 2008.
The reason that we're considering this even now is that the federal courts are redefining marriage when the states have defined it as the union of a man and a woman, and I think that's really what we ought to focus and do.
7 Republicans joined 41 Democrats to vote against the measure, including 2 Republicans who voted differently when the amendment was last proposed in 2004. Supreme Courts in New Jersey, New York, and Washington State are considering lawsuits regarding state marriage laws. The House of Representatives will take up the amendment, which defines marriage as a union between a man and a woman, later this summer. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Darby Hickey in Washington, D.C.
Lawmakers in the Senate this week are taking up same-sex marriage, flag desecration, and a repeal of the estate tax, all of which pleases the Republican base. Democrats say that meanwhile they're avoiding important issues, including the war in Iraq. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell asked Democrats what they're doing to move forward the debate on the war.
The Senate voted down the same-sex marriage ban and then moved to a bill to repeal the estate tax, a tax that hasn't been updated in years and is affecting more of the middle class. Next, the Senate will take up a bill outlawing the desecration of the American flag. All these issues are unifying topics for the Republican Party, something which is needed as they have a president with low poll numbers, corruption scandals in Congress, and divisions within the party over immigration. The Democrats are responding by saying these are not the issues important to Americans. They say the Senate should be debating energy, the war in Iraq, and a slew of other topics. Democrat Carl Levin from Michigan, who is also seeking a nomination for president.
What the hell are these guys talking about?
Are they worried that the three states or five states or seven states that don't have these laws are going to somehow undermine marriage in America while our kids are getting killed? 130,000 people in Iraq is going to hell in a handbasket when we don't have any discussion or debate on Iran. What are we going to go to next, by the way? The flag. How can you desecrate something that isn't consecrated? You know, I mean, this is, I hope it is as transparent to the American people.
Neither the House nor the Senate have had a full debate on the war in Iraq since it began more than 3 years ago. The Democrats blame the Republicans. Patty Murray from Washington.
The Senate is, and the House and the members of Congress are not getting the information they need, and we should be demanding that.
And Democrat Patrick Leahy from Vermont.
The Congress, which normally does oversight, has not, because the Republican leadership said, don't do oversight. Don't ask questions for the screw-ups in Iraq. Don't ask questions when the president says, mission accomplished, that should have been enough. Or bring it on, that should have been enough. Or the vice president says, we'll be welcomed as liberators. Don't ask questions why they were so far wrong.
Since the Republicans control both houses of Congress, they control what issues are brought to be debated. The war in Iraq is unpopular with the American people, but the Republican administration still supports it, which makes it a contentious issue. Republican Senator John McCain, also a potential nominee for the 2008 presidential race.
This could be an opportunity to have a full debate on Iraq.
No. No.
That should happen?
We don't need it.
No?
No.
How come?
Because there's plenty of debate that goes on without bringing it to the floor.
As elevator doors between the two of us closed, McCain said the war is being debated in the media. Is placing blame on the Republicans a cop-out? Senator Leahy took some responsibility.
Democrats can do better. America can do better. We will do better.
But he offered no answers. David Swanson, co-founder of AfterDowningStreet.org, did.
The Democrats individually in both houses often use that cop-out and use it as an excuse not to sign on to a measure because it won't work because we're in the minority. Well, by that logic, they should go home and quit their jobs, right? If all the Democrats line up behind something, then let the media point out that the Republicans are blocking it. In fact, moderate Republicans will be forced to sign on.
Senators John Kerry from Massachusetts, Chuck Hagel from Nebraska, and Russ Feingold from Wisconsin have all offered bills that would lead to an end of the war or to a debate. FSRN asked Senator Levin if Democrats should shut down the Senate until top issues are brought up.
Well, we can, but that doesn't do much because what happens is you still don't get the debate, the forum. That's why this election is so important.
The House of Representatives have 120 co-sponsors to a resolution that would force a full-scale debate on the floor of the House. They still need about 90 more supporters in order for it to be implemented. So peace groups scheduled a national call-in day for today to urge House members to show their support. The Senate Armed Services Committee announced they will hold hearings on the killings by the military in Haditha, Iraq, after investigations are complete. No date has been set. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Religious broadcaster Pat Robertson says that it is the God's honest truth. He did indeed once leg press 2,000 pounds when he was almost 73 years old and had prostate cancer, and he still regularly lifts up to 1,200 pounds with his legs. But he acknowledged that the way he leg presses would probably not be legal in a bodybuilding competition. The 700 Club host's feat is recounted on the website of his Christian Broadcasting Network in Virginia Beach, but sports experts questioned the assertion in recent weeks, with one noting that the all-time leg press record for football players at Florida State University is just over 1,300 pounds.
In his farewell speech to fellow Republicans, former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay urged colleagues today to, quote, stand on principle and ignore the media. DeLay, facing trial in Texas on campaign money laundering charges, is leaving Congress Friday, ending a 21-year career in the House. Several rounds of applause and cheers could be heard from behind the doors of the Republicans' weekly private meeting. When the doors were opened to let a congresswoman in, members could be seen on their feet cheering and applauding. Also today, three Democrats marked DeLay's departure with proposed legislation to reform labor laws in the Northern Mariana Islands, a U.S. territory.
Representative George Miller, Democrat of California, said DeLay and convicted ex-lobbyist Jack Abramoff have thwarted a decade of efforts to lift the island's exemption from a range of U.S. labor, wage, and immigration laws.
A former senior official at Ohio's $15 billion insurance fund for injured workers pleaded guilty today to federal and state charges that he took bribes in exchange for government investment opportunities. The former official, Terrence Gasper, is the first official of the Ohio Bureau of Workers' Compensation to be charged in the investment scandal. Gasper accepted $25,000 from coin dealer Tom Noe, the prominent GOP donor at the heart of a state political scandal, prosecutors say. Noe pleaded guilty last week to illegally funneling money to President Bush's re-election campaign in 2004. He has pleaded not guilty to state charges of stealing more than $1 million from the state insurance fund.
While prison populations are growing astronomically, money for rehabilitation is not keeping pace, fueling violence behind bars. The Commission on Safety and Abuse in America's Prisons is urging a renewed emphasis on rehabilitation, an approach it says was devalued in the 1970s as politicians promoted get-tough-on-crime policies. The panel is co-chaired by former Federal Appeals Court Judge John J. Gibbons, the attorney who successfully argued in the Supreme Court that detainees at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, should have access to U.S. courts, and Nicholas Katzenbach, whose work as a U.S. Attorney General during the Johnson administration and Deputy Attorney General during the Kennedy administration helped desegregate the South. Almost 2.2 million people were in federal and state prisons and local jails last year, up from 1.5 million in 1995. Prisons account for about two-thirds of all inmates, and local jails house the rest.
A man who authorities say was upset about being denied a job as an interpreter for the U.S. military in Iraq was charged with threatening to blow up a Delta Airlines flight. Saleh Al-Sualilam of Boise, Idaho, was arrested by the FBI yesterday. Al-Sualilam was at Fort Benning on Monday undergoing training to become an Arabic interpreter when he learned he would not be hired because he was denied security clearance, federal authorities said in court papers. After being told to fly home to Idaho the next day on a Delta flight, he started drinking with some acquaintances and blurted out, "Okay, I'm going to blow up the plane." When questioned by Fort Benning officials, he said the remark was just a joke. His lawyer did not immediately return a call on Wednesday.
And now, live from death row, Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The word democracy is a kind of verbal narcotic. To mention it is to daze us, to dull us, to lull us to peaceful slumber. That's why the Bush regime, perhaps the least democratic of governments in generations, calls the Iraq invasion and occupation a war for democracy. It is ironic that a government that is profoundly autocratic, that relies on elite authoritarianism, secrecy, wireless wiretaps, secret prisons, and torture, can claim to be fighting for something that is becoming so rare in the U.S., democracy. But don't trip. This ain't a Bush thing. Writer and historian Michael Parenti, in his book Super Patriotism, tells us that democracy has been wiped out in a host of countries by the United States. Parenti writes, U.S. leaders have long professed a dedication to democracy, yet over the last half century, they have devoted themselves to overthrowing democratic governments in Guatemala, Guyana, the Dominican Republic, Brazil, Chile, Uruguay, Syria, Indonesia under Sukarno, Greece twice, Argentina twice, Haiti twice, Bolivia, Jamaica, Yugoslavia, and other countries. These governments were all guilty of pursuing policies that occasionally favored the poorer elements and infringed upon the affluent. In most instances, the U.S.-sponsored coups were accompanied by widespread killings of democratic activists. U.S. leaders have supported covert actions, sanctions, or proxy mercenary wars against revolutionary governments in Cuba, Angola, Mozambique, Ethiopia, Iraq, with the CIA ushering in Saddam Hussein's reign of repression, Portugal, South Yemen, Nicaragua, Cambodia, East Timor, Western Sahara, and elsewhere. There is no rogue state, axis of evil, or communist country that has a comparable record of such criminal aggression against other nations, he writes. That's from Michael Parenti's Super Patriotism. The point? The next time you hear about a war to bring democracy, just question it. Don't let the word drug you into acquiescence. Hey, just say no. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The current time is 5:34, and now time for highfalutin commentary from Jim Hightower.
While senators loudly brag that they're building a big old wall on the Mexican border to keep out immigrants, they very quietly bored a gaping loophole in the law to let hundreds of thousands of low-income foreign workers enter our country and take some of our most essential professional positions. A little-known provision pushed by the giant hospital chains will throw open our borders to foreign nurses, allowing the hospital industry to recruit low-paid trained nurses from the Philippines, India, China, and Africa. These foreign nurses make under $2,000 a year back home and can easily be lured here to take less than the going rate of American professionals. Already, some 14,000 nurses from abroad are given work visas to enter the U.S. each year. But the Senate bill simply removes the cap on these visas, shouting, "Y'all come!" Not only does this corporate-sponsored approach drain medical pros from countries that desperately need them, but it also guts the middle-class pay structure and opportunities for homegrown nursing professionals. The hospital lobby wails that there's a nursing shortage here, so there's no choice but to go outside our borders. Hogwash. There's a shortage because hospitals won't pay what this highly professional job warrants, and because Congress refuses to provide the funding needed to educate more American nurses. Last year alone, some 150,000 qualified applicants were rejected by nursing schools because of inadequate facilities and a lack of faculty to teach them. This is Jim Hightower saying, what we have here is raw corporate greed in action, writing bad immigration policy in order to gain cheap foreign labor. Instead, let's invest in domestic nursing programs that'll build America's middle class, while also improving the quality of our health care. For more information, call the American Nurses Association, 1-800-274-4262. Today's commentary is made possible in part by the good folks at Mother Jones Magazine. Over the years, Mother Jones has won just about every award available while ticking off the honchos of business and government. They're proud of both distinctions. Find out more at MotherJones.com.
Stay tuned for Independent Native News following our newscast. Then at 6 p.m. here, Circle A Radio. The topic is the new pro-democracy movement in Nepal. At 7, it's nonstop hip-hop with DJ Audio. Weather in the Willamette Valley is cloudy and warm, but dry. Highs around 70. In the Columbia River Gorge, cloudy and highs in the mid-70s. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
In the Philippines today, prosecutors in a rape trial involving four U.S. Marines accused the U.S. Embassy of delaying the proceedings by refusing to allow American Navy investigators to testify. The judge in the case ordered the embassy to explain the situation after a U.S. Navy investigator who testified for the prosecution Monday was barred from appearing again today. U.S. Embassy officials could not immediately be reached for comment on why the investigator did not appear. Prosecutors allege Lance Corporal Smith raped a 22-year-old Filipino woman on November 1st, while others, Lance Corporal Keith Silkwood, Lance Corporal Dominic Duplantis, and Staff Sergeant Chad Carpentier cheered him on. The rape charges are punishable by up to 40 years in prison. The Marines have refused to answer the charges, and the judge has entered a plea of innocence for them.
A small group of U.S. Marines alleged to have killed up to two dozen Iraqi civilians conducted a house-to-house hunt that stretched over 3 hours. Meanwhile, other Marines in Haditha did not intervene, according to an Iraqi human rights investigator. The Associated Press interview of the Iraqi investigator is the most detailed account yet of Iraqi accusations that Marines went on a rampage after a comrade was killed by a bomb. Two separate U.S. military investigations of the incident are underway. Ta'er al-Hadithi, a member and spokesman for the Hammurabi Human Rights Association, a Sunni Muslim group, recounted with the help of a satellite map when and where Iraqi civilians cowered and sometimes died. The case first came to public attention 2 months ago because of a video released by the Hammurabi group. The military, after initially saying the Iraqi deaths were the result of the roadside bomb and a subsequent gunfight with insurgents, has not publicly released updated findings.
The nation's number one Marine says that he is gravely concerned about allegations that his forces committed atrocities against Iraqi civilians. General Michael Higgy, won't say what evidence has been found, but he's promising to hold accountable any Marine found guilty of abuses. Asked whether he's considering quitting over the multiple allegations, the Commandant says he serves at the pleasure of the President and has not submitted his resignation. One case under investigation centers on allegations that a small band of Marines went on a killing rampage in Haditha. The Marines now say their initial account of the roadside bombing and insurgent gun battle was wrong. A second case alleges that Marines pulled an unarmed Iraqi from his house in Hamdaniya, killed him, and planted evidence to make him look like a militant.
Iraq's leading Sunni political party today accused U.S. forces of a string of massacres against innocent civilians. Among the incidents listed by Iraqi Islamic Party spokesman Omar al-Jaburi are the May 13th bombings of a civilian car in Latifia that killed six people, an air attack on the same day on a civilian home that left a family of seven dead. The next day, the party says U.S. forces carried out another airstrike on the house of a sheikh in the town of Yusifia, killing 13 people, including women and children. On the same day in Baghdad's Yarmouk district, the party says U.S. forces raided a home, killing the head of the household and his son. Meanwhile, Iraqis have been killing each other in a tremendous upsurge of sectarian violence. FSRN's Aaron Glantz and Salam Talib report.
Violence continued to escalate across southern Iraq. The Iraqi Ministry of Interior reports today 14 civilians were killed and 8 others wounded in Basra, which had been relatively peaceful until recently. According to the ministry, unidentified men in cars opened fire at close range against pedestrians, including women and children. The wave of violence in primarily Shiite Basra left many Sunni citizens dead and forced hundreds more to flee their homes. But it's not just Sunnis who are getting killed and displaced in Iraq. Baghdad journalist Mu'ayyad al-Hamdani.
When I went to Abu Ghraib, I saw that many Shiite houses were empty. I saw this while I was documenting the Sunni families who were forced to leave Shaula. I saw many families there that came from Baghdad, and even now inside Baghdad, I can see there is ethnic cleansing inside Baghdad itself. And this is an indicator for this big plan to destroy Iraq into small pieces. And this plan is not made just by the militias. It's supported by the government security forces.
The Iraqi government announced this week 180,000 Iraqis have been displaced in the ongoing sectarian violence. 17,000 families are now registered homeless. An additional 5,000 are not homeless, but have fled their homes to live with family in safer parts of the country. Ahmed al-Ahmed is manager of the Human Rights Association in primarily Shiite Diwaniya.
I don't understand why this is happening. The Shia are going to the south, and the Sunni have to leave to go to the west. We have in Diwaniya thousands of refugees. We have 700 families from the last 2 months alone. Most of them are coming from the areas of Abu Ghraib, Mahmoudiya, Latifiya, and Dura. They didn't commit any crime. It's just because they are Shia and they are living in a Sunni area.
Two of the most powerful Iraqi political factions, the Kurdish political parties and the Shiite Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, support making Iraq into a federal republic, where different parts of the country have great autonomy. Former Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari supported a strong central government, but he was forced to resign. Mazen Lido Ravi, professor of law at Qaysadiya University in Diwaniya.
It seems the fighting will continue, and we have to deal with it because the government isn't even thinking about having a reaction to it. And I think that is very dangerous, because now they are thinking about settling them permanently in areas where there are refugees. If they did that, that will be the first step in destroying Iraq and cutting it to small pieces.
Many Iraqis suspect a U.S. role in the increasing call for federalism. Professor Mazen Lido Ravi says many Iraqis are being pushed to the conclusion that living in ethnically pure areas is the only way to stay alive.
Federalism is a political system, and it's an economic system, and it's a security system. But now people are looking at it as just a security guarantee, which is the only thing that people think about now. They don't think about it as a political or economic process for them. They don't even care about democracy while they are thinking about security. And I think the exiling of Sunnis to the west and Shia to the south sends a message to the people that it's better for you to be with your own people, which is now the only way to guarantee your security.
U.S. forces in Iraq remain focused on fighting the so-called insurgency in the west of the country. According to the Pentagon, 1,500 additional U.S. troops have been brought to Iraq for a massive assault expected soon on the city of Ramadi. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Aaron Glantz with Salam Talib.
Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki ordered the release of 2,500 detainees today in a gesture to promote national reconciliation. Al-Maliki announced the gesture as in an attempt to calm tensions between Iraq's two main sectarian groups and to defuse some of the anger towards the U.S. presence there. U.S. and Iraqi forces have detained tens of thousands of Iraqi men on suspicion of involvement in the insurgency.
Romania and Poland denounced a new EU report that said there is evidence that the two countries housed secret CIA jails. The report also says several European countries have been complicit in assisting the CIA in the practice known as extraordinary rendition. Naomi Fowler has more from London.
According to this report, many European states contravened the European Convention on Human Rights as well as domestic criminal law by either allowing the CIA to snatch their own residents, giving them extensive logistical support, or simply turning a blind eye. The chairman of the European Council's Legal Affairs and Human Rights Committee, Dick Marty, said today that far from being tricked by a CIA plot, 14 European states were fully aware of most of what was going on. The Council of Europe says Britain not only allowed the use of British airspace and airports, but even provided information that was used during the torture of one terrorist suspect. The report also provides the first official confirmation that some flight records correspond with accounts given by people who say they were abducted and transferred to secret jails by the CIA. There's also strong evidence that Poland and Romania permitted the CIA to operate secret prisons on their soil. Tony Blair said today that the British government had no more to add to what it had already said and that it had kept Parliament informed. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Grenade attacks in Indian-administered Kashmir have targeted tourists in four separate incidents in the last few weeks. The attacks have been a blow to the tourism industry in Kashmir, which expected another booming season after record tourist arrivals in the last few years. Shahnawaz Khan has more.
Four tourists were killed in a grenade attack on a tourist vehicle last month in Indian-administered Kashmir. The attack came at a time when Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh was chairing the roundtable conference on Kashmir in Srinagar. On May 31, scores of tourists were injured as a tourist coach was attacked near Dal Lake, a tourist hub in Srinagar. Soon after the attack, tour operators from other parts of India cancelled events, sending Kashmir's tourism industry into a panic. S.R. Gupta is a tour operator in Kolkata.
According to the situation, we have been advised then not to go over Srinagar, just go by surroundings, just like Jammu, Katra, and Vaishnavi, and then come back to Kolkata.
Kashmir's tourism department has remained silent on the issue, while those in the industry are trying not to succumb to the impact. Azim Tuman is the chairman of Kashmir Houseboat Association.
For 2-3 days, there was definitely, shortfall in arrivals. And there were some cancellations also. But thank God, it has died down slowly and gradually. Since past 2-3 days, we have been seeing the tourists are moving around and then they are coming in. Therefore now, we hope that things will improve.
Muhammad Hafiz Shala is a tour operator in Srinagar. Hafiz admits the attacks had a negative impact, but hopes that impact will not last long. Hafiz, however, blames the Indian government for holding roundtable conference during the peak tourist season. Moment for tourists and locals was hampered last month due to heavy security for the conference.
Whatever the conferences happen, they should do other parts of India. India is very big. If they have to discuss anything, they should come on the table and discuss. But why only particular area of Kashmir Valley? And a lot of tourists got a disturbance in Srinagar while they was in holiday in Kashmir. Most of the roads was under security. And those tourist coaches have to come different parts of countryside, different parts of roads. I think that was not a good sign for the tourism in Kashmir Valley.
During the 16-year insurgency, attacks on tourists have been rare in Kashmir. Most separatist groups, including hardline guerrillas, have condemned the recent attacks. Tourist bodies in Kashmir are demanding a government probe into the attacks, as none of the militant groups have claimed responsibility for the attacks. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Shahnawaz Khan.
Six elderly Guatemalans were rushed to the hospital as they are part of a group of 35 who have been on a 48-hour hunger strike, demanding the government fulfill its pension promises. Jill Rapogel reports from Guatemala City.
They are protesting the suspension of a law that would provide a monthly pension of around $65 to poor elderly citizens who have no other source of income. The law, which was passed by Congress last November, would benefit around 60,000 elderly folks. It was included in a package of laws that all congressional party blocs agreed to pass to compensate the potentially negative effects of the U.S. Central American Free Trade Agreement, CAFTA. The hunger strikers say they'll hold out until the country's constitutional court agrees to reverse an earlier decision to suspend the law. Héctor Montenegro Castellanos, president of the National Association of Elderly Without Social Security Coverage.
Estamos dispuestos, preferible morir acá.
We'd rather die here than wait to die of hunger at home. Only around 11% of old people in Guatemala have some type of pension, according to a recent study cited in a local newspaper. Jill Replogle, FSRN, Guatemala City.
More than 11,000 villagers have been evacuated from around the Indonesian volcano Mount Merapi following fresh lava flows. Thousands of people were evacuated at the first signs of activity in May. Scientists fear the volcano's lava dome could collapse, sending gas and debris down into populated areas. Mount Merapi is one of 129 active volcanoes in Indonesia. 60 people were killed when it last erupted in 1994, and about 1,300 people died in 1930.
A United Nations report on migration says that 191 million people now live outside their country of origin. The report said the figures are up by about a quarter since 1990, with one in five moving to rich countries. In some countries, money sent home from abroad accounts for a large proportion of the national income. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan warned that the benefits of migration depended on the rights of migrants being upheld.
Hundreds of Brazilian protesters demanding land reform have stormed a parliament building. About 20 people were injured in clashes with police. It is thought they are members of a radical group that has split from the larger landless workers' movement. President Lula da Silva was elected in 2003, had promised to buy disused land and redistribute it to 400,000 homeless families by 2006, but the protesters say the government has failed to live up to its promises.
Namibia has confirmed that seven people have died of polio in the country's first outbreak in more than a decade. 27 others have been paralyzed by the disease. Vaccination campaigns have been carried out on the under-5s in Namibia since 1990. A health ministry official says that as most of the victims were over 20, they had probably missed out on immunization. Although efforts to eradicate the disease have intensified, polio has resurfaced in Africa in recent years.
That's the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 7th, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you've heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203. Or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You're listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer of tonight's newscast is Lisa Loving. Tonight's wire editors are Eve Sokolai and Lynn Molick. Special thanks to reporters Doug Guidi, Edison Carter, and Jacob Fenston, who is also our engineer this evening. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Afifa Ahmed Shafi. Stay tuned for Independent Native News. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. And at 7:30, it's Joanne Bowman, hosting Voices from the Edge Talk Radio. Her guest is Daryl Mooch, Executive Director of Brother to Brother, a community-based organization that works to support African-American men who are gay, bi, and transgendered. They will discuss Portland Black Pride and a 2 days of community workshops, music, and events to build stronger relationships between the broader African-American community. At 9, it's Press Watch, the news you're not supposed to know with Therese Mitchell. At 9:30, Per Fagering hosts a pilot edition of Fight the Empire. His topic is, how did the Middle East get like this? A history since World War I.
At 10, it's Chicanismo with host Carlos Chavez. At 10:30, Portland artist Tom Kramer guest hosts Art Focus. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. One more thing. Are you a newsaholic? The KBOO News is looking for people who love to think, write, and investigate, and have free time during the day. To find out more, call Lisa Loving at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Have a good evening.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 6th of June. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. Last month's failing report by Canada's Auditor General may help some First Nation leaders in the Yukon get their message to Ottawa. The AG, Sheila Fraser, was critical of the way Aboriginal programs are managed, including housing initiatives. The CBC's Doris Bill has more on the story.
Housing is a pressing issue across the north. In the small central Yukon community of Carmacks, the problems are urgent. Some residents have been forced from their homes because of mold. The community has also issued a boil water advisory for its citizens because of an inadequate water and sewer system. Ottawa has given some money to First Nations on reserve for things like mold, but most Yukon First Nation communities are excluded. That's because they are not reserves, but are self-governing. The chief of CARMAX says getting Ottawa to pay attention to some of the issues is a lot tougher than it used to be. Chief Eddie Skookum.
We thought in the first instance when we passed all our motions to become a self-governing nation, that we could get a handle on those dollars, but apparently somewhere down the line the rules changed.
The Auditor General's report says the federal government has made some progress. One example is the recent announcement of $300 million for housing across the north. That money is supposed to go to putting families in affordable homes. Skookum is pleased with the money, but says they should be able to spend it on their most pressing needs. Yukon Chiefs will be taking their message to Ottawa in the wake of the Auditor General's report. They want to urge the federal government to live up to its obligations that are laid out in Yukon land claim agreements. Doris Bill, Whitehorse.
A coalition of Native American groups in South Dakota, Montana, and Wyoming are struggling to stop a proposed biker bar and campground from going in near the sacred site of Bear Butte. The site is near the massive Sturgis Rally, which draws in a 500,000 bikers once a year. Citizens are calling for a public vote to reverse the malt beverage license given to the establishment. But whether or not there will be an election is up to the courts. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Charles Michael Ray has the story.
Meade County citizens opposed to the issuing of a malt beverage license for a biker campground near Bear Butte petitioned for a public vote. But the county commission is refusing to hold an election. Bruce Ellison is one of three attorneys who have filed a case in circuit court. Ellison says the commission has denied citizens their democratic right.
To me, it's very disturbing as a citizen of the state when any governing body refuses to perform their statutory legal obligations, their duties, especially in this instance where for over 90 years, this has been the law in South Dakota, and to even claim otherwise suggests a certain hostility towards democracy.
But the state's attorney for Meade County, Ken Kloberad, says the granting of a malt beverage license is an administrative act, not a legislative one. So he says it's not referable to the voters. Opponents to the malt beverage license hope the courts disagree and grant a referendum before the biker rally in August. Charles Michael Ray, Rapid City, South Dakota.
There's a deal in the works to prevent the export of a rare coat made by Innu artists in the 1700s. The painted caribou skin coat is now owned by an art dealer in Toronto. Last year, a private American buyer tried to purchase the coat for $180,000. Government regulations have given Canadian buyers until June 9th to intervene. Now it looks like the Rooms Provincial Museum, Labrador's Innu Nation, and Canadian Heritage will pool their resources to buy the coat. Museum Director Penny Holden says the province would act as the artifact's caretaker until the Innu acquire proper facilities to store and display it.
At that point in time, the coat would be transferred to the Innu Nation, which means that
they would have something available for exhibition and for study at all times in Labrador.
Holden says negotiations are ongoing with the owner of the coat. William Jameson says he's willing to reduce his price to $130,000 if it means the artifact will stay in Canada. This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by News from Indian Country's e-edition, online at IndianCountryNews.com. Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.
Good evening. It is coming up to 6 o'clock, the hour of 6, and you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is Circle A, and the topic tonight is the movement for democracy in Nepal.